on a cold, sunlit morning a couple of weeks ago, 50 fundraisers from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, gathered at a cemetery called Poke Capel, British cemetery. These people had been walking for 2 full days across the Somme and then the Arras, Vimy battlefields. And it was about 7:30, 7:45 on a cold, on this cold October morning. And a number of them were drawn to a special memorial. Along the wall, just inside the entrance of the cemetery, a special memorial because it's known to be the final resting place of a particular soldier that we'd come to see. But in the later fighting, his actual location within the cemetery has been lost. And that soldier is, or was, Second Lieutenant Hugh Gordon Langton from the 4th Battalion of the London Regiment, the Royal Fusiliers, who was killed in action in the midst of the Passchendaele, the Battle of Passchendaele, that awful battle in 1917 on the 26th of October 1917. And he was 32 years old. But why were we drawn to this particular grave? There's lots of notable burials in this cemetery, not least a man who's supposed to be 14 years old, a young boy, an Irishman called James Condon, who's buried just a few yards away from Langton. But we were drawn to his grave because this man, Hugh, was a very promising violinist. He'd been taught by some of the most prominent music teachers from around Europe. And as far as we know, and of course we may be wrong, he's the only one of all the Commonwealth graves and memorials in the world that has musical notes inscribed as his epitaphs. The family inscription on the base of the grave, which so many of us turn to when we reach any of these graves, we always read from the bottom. Now, for years, it was thought that the piece had been taken from a popular song from 1891 called After the Ball. But in recent years, some musical scholars have suggested a different composition altogether. So to explain the story, we turn to a local Belgium battlefield guide called Jill Bossiet. And once again, my pronunciations are terrible. I apologise to Jill if I've got that wrong, which I probably have. But he tells the story of this man, and we listen to some of the music that we think came from within the mind of this very talented musician.
I read on the Commonwealth website about the notes on the grave of Hugh Gordon Langton. And it's very special as it is the only Commonwealth grave of the thousands of them. There's a musical note on it. So I suggested to the group of musicians I knew to write a piece of music around this this theme of these notes. That's what they did. So it's like a sort of a mystery. Still, it is a mystery. There are lots of theories about it, where the notes come from, really. And Roland Corain and André de Waller composed a musical piece around this little musical phrase. The moment he came here was the 15th of October 1917, and just 2 weeks after he died. He died some further up there, near Trekkers Farm, with the 4th Battalion, London Regiment. So in this environment, he died on the 26th of October. So the story is really Passchendaele, muddy conditions, no more trenches, only shell holes to hide in. So the conditions wherein he died were dreadful. Really great to see today that the small idea of doing something with these notes, even a small event, but a nice event, as we had today, so that the people were so enthusiastic to come here to play this piece at the memorial for Hugh Gordon Langton. So it was a very moving moment for me, and I think for everybody who was here.
So thanks there to Jill for telling us that story. There'll be much more coming up from him next year when we travel to the Ypres area, and he's going to take us around and tell us lots of stories that he's discovered in his home country. So So welcome to this week's edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week, the podcast is going to follow these 50 frontline walkers from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, as they walked the 100 kilometres or 60 miles over 3 days from the Lough Neagh crater on the Somme, ended up at the Menin Gate in Ypres, bruised, battered, emotional, blisters all over their toes for many of them. But boy, did these people raise a lot of money. At the last count, it was getting on towards £100,000 that they'd raised for the National Charity of the British Army. This wonderful charity has been going since 1944. The clue is in the name, really. It raises funds for soldiers, veterans and their immediate families. Half of the money that we raise goes directly to beneficiaries of the charities, and we hear from one of them in this podcast. And the other half goes to smaller charities that enables them to provide grants to soldiers and veterans and their families as well. And the idea is that we give these men and women a hand up, not a hand out. We help them readjusting maybe to civilian life after years in the armed forces where they've been, everything's been done for them and they might struggle to find accommodation and jobs. We help them with university scholarships, as in this case. We hear from a veteran who's gone on to get an art degree from the depths of depression. He's managed to pull his life around with help from the charity. So what I wanted to do in this week's podcast was to walk with those people across the battlefields and talk about some of the stories that we found in the cemeteries and in the fields of the Somme, the Vimy Ridge area, and finally across those battlefields of Passchendaele in the summer of autumn of 1917. Come with us as we do the frontline walk. So it was in 2014 that the frontline walk began, and we've only missed 2020 because of COVID. And as usual, we began at the Lough Neagh crater, which we talked about in one of our, or several of our previous podcasts. And it was dark when the walkers gathered there. We had a vicar with us, Andy Herrick, a retired vicar, and he said a few words to get us on our way. And the walkers trudged off towards Freecor in the darkness. Half of the walkers probably had done the walk before. The other half were extremely anxious. What were they going to find? How difficult was the walk going to be? Were they going to get on with their fellow walkers? Some of these people coming along on their own, as so many of us had done in the past. But off they went, walking those battlefields that so many years ago, many of their relatives had walked. Some had returned, many hadn't, and we were going to discover their stories along the way. So their first stop was at the Flatiron Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, situated close to Mametz Wood, where so many of those Welshmen fell in July of 1916. There are now 1,572 Commonwealth servicemen of the First World War buried or commemorated in this cemetery. And from there, the walkers moved up to a road that runs between Bazentin and Contlemason, just to the north of Mametz Wood. And walk along there they did, getting to know each other, chatting enthusiastically. And then they stopped and they looked across a field between Mametz Wood and Bazentin Wood. And it was here at dawn on the 14th of July 1916 that the second phase of the Battle of the Somme began. The dawn attack, as it became known. This was the day that the creeping barrage was first introduced and proved that just within 2 weeks of that disastrous 1st of July, the opening day of the Battle of the Somme, that the BEF had learned their lessons. They'd learned from the mistakes they'd made just, 14 days before. And there's nothing there now. There's just a field between the two woods, which had recently been ploughed, and no doubt was still giving up more of its secrets from that day in July 1916. But we were here to think about just one man, a man called Second Lieutenant Archibald Gordon Edward Bow. And I brought one of his relatives here about 10 years ago, following in the footsteps of Archibald. And we walked out of Mametz Wood on that summer's day and across that field, heading towards what was the German front line, just in front of Bazentin Wood. He was a 26-year-old man from London Road in Leicester, a and he was the bombing officer in his unit, which means his job was to lead the attack and throw hand grenades into the German trenches. And as the frontline walkers passed the point where Archibald led his men into action, I placed his photograph next to the farm track, which in those days was a railway line. And this is the exact point where he led his men of the 8th Battalion of the Leicestershire Regiment into action in that dawn attack. So what happened to Archibald, and what was it like as they made their way up to the jumping off position on the evening of the 13th of July? Well, we know, because I've got here a letter that was written by one of Archibald's comrades. And this is what I read to the walkers as they passed that spot. It says it was a trying time, walking and creeping in single file the 2 miles of unknown country where shells were continually dropping. And of course, what they were doing was following the route to previous battles over the last 2 weeks. And our correspondent goes on to say, our boys and the Boche were lying along the route in all kinds of attitudes and sights, I believe, that raised a cold, determined feeling for our men to do his bit, whether we came out or not. I myself and all the boys were the same, quiet but cool and steady, not excited and dozed with rum as we had so many times heard of in these attacks. There is none of this alcohol given to the boys to install false courage. We followed a white tape through Mametz Wood. We were all together in the wood about 2 hours. That was the most trying time, as we had to lay there on the outskirts where the Germans were dropping these heavy coal boxes. We heard some terrible cries of men maimed for life, a much worse sensation than a man killed. That indeed is a blessing, instantaneous death. The reason why I've used this letter is because it really takes us into the minds of those men as they moved up through what must have been a horrible sight in Mametz Wood after what had gone on the previous week between the Welsh and the Prussian guards. It then goes on to say how they moved up to the front line. We then had orders to file out of the wood through a gap where a light railway ran out to Bazentin. We advanced 50 yards and lay in the open in comparative safety to the place in the woods. I remember my own feelings of relief were marvellous. We started talking to one another. The last instructions were given to me by my officer, a Mr. Greenaway, only 21, to pass on to the next man. The order was to, as soon as you're in sight of the German front line, every man to do a right turn and follow me in file. He did get there, and the remaining men, about a dozen, but was killed just after. But just after this order, your son, Archibald, came along looking for his bombers and getting them together 20 yards in front of us. This was the last I saw him. But on the boat, I met one of his bombers who was in the shell hole with him. He told me he was shot while shouting out the order to advance. He just got the words out and was shot through the head, being killed instantaneously. The attack was timed for 3:25 a.m. Your boy would be killed at 3:23, just before our barrage fire lifted on July the 14th, Friday morning. It would be a machine gun bullet. The attack on Bazentin Ridge was successful. The Leicestershires took most of their objectives that day. But as we know, Archibald was killed and his body was no doubt buried by his comrades, but then was lost to the later fighting. And he's on Tietvau, and we saw his name on Tietvau Memorial later on that day when we stopped for lunch. And he was just one man, one soldier, one officer leading his men. But those people that passed that point a couple of weeks ago will never forget him. And that's why 50 of us have given up a week of our lives to put ourselves through the pain and the agony and the mental torture of this frontline walk. And along the way, they're going to discover dozens more stories that tell the story of the frontline walk. And it's just a few of them that we're going to talk about in this podcast today. As I said just now, those walkers will never forget Archibald, and hopefully you guys listening to this podcast won't forget either. And if you ever walk along that road, just north of Mametz Wood, between Bazentin and Contlemason, you'll see a track on the right-hand side, opposite the wood. And as you pass, just think of Archibald. Think of what he went through that morning, and just imagine that he may still be out there in that field. We'll never know, of course. Now, I mentioned that the walkers stopped at Flatiron Copse, and as they did so, they entered the cemetery, and our main historian for the tour, Steve Roberts, who's featured in our podcast before, he played a recording of a VC reciprocant, Edward Dwyer. Now, Dwyer had been awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions at Hill 60 in April 1915, and in his own words, he said that his trench was heavily attacked by German grenade throwers. I climbed onto the parapet, and although subjected to a hail of bombs at close quarters, I succeeded in dispersing the enemy by the use of hand grenades. He said, when I came home, the King sent for me to go to Buckingham Palace. His Majesty shook hands with me, and I told him what I'd done. He was ever so nice to me, and smiled when he shook hands after pinning the VC on my breast. He's a king worth fighting for, King George. I'd never expected to get out of the fight I'd ever been in, and so I'll always just try and do my bit and leave it at that. Well, they were shelling our trench pretty badly, and after a time all our chaps were either killed or wounded. Some of the papers have said that the other chaps retired. They didn't retire. The wounded may have crawled. At last I was the only unwounded man left in the trench. There were three steps leading up to the parapet of the trench, and I sat crouched on the middle step. Shells and hand bombs were bursting all over and around, but nothing touched me at all. We had a lot of hand grenades in our trench, and I added to my stock by gathering up all I could find. I suppose I had about 300 in all. Then I went back to crouch in the middle of the step. The fear of being taken prisoner was very strong upon me. A straight shot, a round hole in the forehead, it's all right. A soldier can't complain about that. Be taken prisoner by those Huns. Ugh. So I gave it to them good and hot. I did a few of them in. If they'd only known that I was the last man, they would have rushed me, and by now I should have been a dead prisoner. Now, Corporal Dwyer then went home, and he was involved in the national recruiting drive, and he became well known as the Little Corporal. But he went back to the front line, and here on the Somme, on the 3rd of September 1960, aged just 20, he was killed. And as the frontline walkers gathered at his grave, we actually listened to this man's voice. It was a voice from the grave, a grave that we were all looking at. And he even sang a song for us. We're here because we're here.
There was only one thing you could cheer us up on the march, that was singing. We used to sing sippy choruses, invented by some of the chaps. Tipperary was in full swing then, and they'd always gone to something they'd invented themselves. It used to buck us up, and we would march all the better for it. Sometimes we'd sing some of T.H. Eliot's songs, you know, the chocolate-coloured tune, but we'd always go into something we'd invented. I don't think I've got much of a voice for singing, but I'd try and sing one or two of the choruses we used to sing. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. We'd be far better off, far better off, far better off in a hut. Here we are, here we are again. Hello, 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 hello. Ooh. Here we are again. Hello, 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 hello.
Ooh. So from the south of the Somme battlefield, we moved up to Teepvale for lunch. And then we walked down Mill Lane, past the Ulster Memorial, through Newfoundland Park and into the village of Beaumont Hamel, and the Sunken Road, and a brief visit to the Hawthorne Crater, all places that we talked about in previous editions of Tales from the Battlefields. Then they walked up the Redan Ridge, past the three cemeteries up there, down the hill, past the vast Sayre Road number 2, and number 1 cemetery with all their stories, and into the Sheffield Memorial Park. This is a wooded area that was once the original frontline trenches of various Powell's battalions from the north of England, famous Powell's battalions like the Sheffield Powell's, the Barnsley Powell's, the Accrington Powell's. And you can see the remains of some of the trenches within the wood and the shell holes. And then No Man's Land moves uphill towards the village of Sayre, which none of them got to, and the German defences that you can see on the horizon, or the locations of the German defences, they're not there anymore. But it was one particular soldier that we told the story of that day, a man called Second Lieutenant William Hurst. And he got married on the 11th of August 1915 to a Miss Bertha Lockwood. And that was shortly before the Barnsley Powells came over to the Western Front. We have an account of what happened to him from a Private Franklin Lee of the same battalion, the 2nd Barnsley Powells. And he says of that moment just before 0 hour on the 1st of July 1916, the birds were singing in the copses around. It was a beautiful day, beautiful. We had this morning chorus and then it all happened just like a flash. We were stood there waiting, ready for the officer to blow his whistle. And our barrage lifted and then bang. A great mine went up on the right hand side. We saw it going sky high, one huge mass of soil. It shouldn't have gone up until we were on the top because it alerted the Germans and they were waiting for us. And when we attacked, they cut us to ribbons. They totally ripped us to shreds. What he was talking about there over on the right-hand side was the Hawthorne mine crater being blown. He says, I was in the first wave on the extreme left. We scrambled onto the fire step and then onto the top when I glanced over. They were all going on our right. There was nothing on our left. There was no cheering. We just ambled across. You hadn't a thought. You were so addled with the noise. And Second Lieutenant Hurst was near to me, almost touching. He'd just got wed before we came away and was a grand chap. But it wasn't long before he got his head knocked off. Now, by this time of the day, the frontline walkers had walked 20 miles and were totally exhausted. They were coming through in their dribs and drabs. But I stood there as they passed and showed them a photo of both William and his bride, Bertha. And I told them not just of his story, but of the fact that he was found, his body was found, and he was buried in one of the cemeteries behind the lines. And his wife chose the family inscription, those words on the base of the grave, and she simply said, "All I had, I gave." And then the walkers moved on to their final point, their end point of day one after 23 miles, and that was in the village of Heberturn, where they enjoyed a beer, and the owner of the cafe there in of the bar there in Heberturn came out with some biscuits and some Madeira cake that he gave to the hungry and thirsty and weary frontline walkers. Now, day two of the frontline walk is a grueling day. In the morning, the walkers have to face the task of moving up through the woodland at the base of the hill, and at the top of that hill is the vast French National Cemetery known as Notre Dame de Lorette. And within this burial ground, over 40,000 Frenchmen are buried. And that's where they have their lunch before, in the afternoon, going down the hill and then up where they end at Vimy Ridge. But along the way, they pass some more incredible stories of soldiers that gave their lives for their nation in the Great War. Before they'd gone very far, they came upon the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery at Mariel, British Cemetery. And within there is a man called Corporal Frederick Charles Burchill. And he was serving with the 3rd Division of the Canadian Field Artillery. And he was killed just after Christmas in 1916, the 27th of December 1916, at the age of just 23. And the story we have about him, about Frederick, he was in charge of a heavy trench mortar gun, and after it had been loaded, he examined it and then pulled the lanyard to fire the gun. The explosion of the charge was heard. The mortar bomb didn't actually leave the gun itself. Corporal Burchill rushed into the emplacement. He saw that the bed of the gun had slipped and the bomb had hit the front of the emplacement and rolled back. He realised the danger that everybody was in. He warned the crew of what had happened. He got them out of the pit that they were in, but before he could get clear himself, the mortar bomb exploded, killing him instantly. And on his headstone, his family have used these words, describing what actually happened to him. It says, "Killed in action in his trench mortar pit by explosion of shell, having warned his men who were all saved." And he was from St. John's, the capital of Newfoundland. Having considered that story, the four walkers moved on, and a couple of hours later found themselves in the beautiful cemetery known as Ecouvre Military Cemetery. which is really at the base of Vimy Ridge and contains the graves of so many men that fell during the 1917 battles at Vimy. But here I took the frontline walkers to one particular grave, and that was a grave of a man called Private James Oliver of the 9th Battalion, the Loyal North Lancashire Regiment, who died on the 14th of August 1916. Now, James, although he was an infantryman, had been seconded to the Royal Engineers, and they were just started digging the 13 or so tunnels that were to be the preparation for the Battle of Vimy Ridge that was to take place, what, 6 months later, more than that, 8 months later. And he was involved in digging the Grange Tunnel. And if you go to Vimy Ridge now, Grange Tunnel is the one, the only tunnel that's open to the public. He was one of seven men that died that day in horrific circumstances. The unit diary tells us what happened. It says the enemy blew a small mine or an overcharged camouflage on the right front of P-75, forming a small crater. No damage was done to the trenches or underground, but an immediate inrush of gas took place, killing all the men working underground before they could be removed by the rescue party. There were seven casualties, all killed by carbon monoxide gas poisoning. And three of those men that died that day with James are buried in the same row in that cemetery. And we took the time to think about his story. He's not killed rushing into battle, going into battle. He's killed by carbon monoxide poisoning. Odourless, colourless, wouldn't have known much about it until he started, along with his mates, struggling to breathe. And a few years ago, I brought two of his relatives to this spot. I didn't tell them what had happened to their relative. All they knew is that he'd been killed in action. But I took them into the Grange Tunnel, and just as we were about to come out, where that explosion took place, I told them that they were standing on the spot where their relative had died. And then a few minutes later, they were kneeling where we were standing, looking at the grave of James Oliver and wondering, like so many others, what would become of him had he survived that awful day in August 1916. So having had their morning tea break, the walkers moved on to their lunch break up the hill towards the French National Cemetery. Before they did that, they visited the village station cemetery. And here there are a number of notable graves. There are 32 Germans buried here, but they're in a mass grave and there's only one headstone that represents all 32 of them. And there's also the grave of Lieutenant John Armstrong from the 11th Field Company Canadian Engineers. He was killed in action on the first day of the Battle of Vimy, 9th of April 1917. And in civilian life, he'd worked as a surveyor for the Canadian government. And as a tribute to him, there's a mountain in the Canadian Rockies that is named Mount Armstrong. And I remember seeing that myself when I went there on holiday a few years ago. There's also, I think I counted about seven men that were shot at dawn. And there's also the grave of an officer, Lieutenant Norman Eden Walker, and he was fondly known as Eden. Another Canadian died on the 13th of April 1917 at just 20 years old. And I've got here a copy of a letter that was sent to his mother by his cousin, a fellow officer in the Canadian Army, Philip Edward Williams. He said to Eden's mum, "I wrote you a letter yesterday, but since I got the awful news that Eden had been killed. When I was up there, I met a Lieutenant Wood who was slightly wounded by the same shell that killed poor Eden, so I got the exact story. Wood had been laying out Eden's party to clean out a trench and was returning along the top of the trench with another engineer officer towards the front line when a whiz-bang hit near them. He took no notice of it but went on, and another hit a little bit closer. He then spoke to the other officer and they got down to the trench where they found Eden, Watson and an officer of another unit. He stayed there and the officer went on. Several more shells came over, so they got down as low as possible, but one struck the side of the trench, killing Eden instantly and wounding the other three. This was the last shell fired. I will certainly send a flower from Eden's grave the next chance I get to go up to the cemetery. It's a pity that he was killed. He was so much loved by all his relations." So then it was to lunch and we were halfway through the frontline walk. We enjoyed a hot meal of meatballs in pasta. And while we were doing that, I sat down with one of the beneficiaries of the Soldiers' Charity, one of the many men and women that's benefited from the efforts of the frontline walkers. And he told us his story. He told us how the charity had helped him from the depths of depression, really, and given him a purpose and a meaning to his life. And this is something that the charity's done for so many people over the years. And with the generosity of our supporters, what we'll continue to do forevermore. This is his story.
So it's day two of the frontline walk, and I'm sitting here with a British Army veteran called John, and he's been struggling around like everyone else for the last 2 days. But John has gone through other struggles in his life thanks to his service with the British Army. So what I thought would be a nice thing to do for the podcast is let John tell his own story, really. He talked to us last night over dinner. You could have heard a pin drop while you were talking yesterday. And I know it was a highly emotional experience. So let's have a go at... how old were you when you joined the British Army then, John?
17.
Why did you do that?
I don't know, really, because in my day, it was a good alternative to work. Mm. And a good opportunity to travel.
And where did you travel to?
Ireland.
And this was in the early 70s?
In the early 70s,
So this is at the height of the Troubles?
The worst year.
And what year was that?
1972.
Is this Bloody Sunday, that sort of period?
Yeah.
So what were your... Do you want to talk about your experiences over there? Is it something you can do for me?
Well, in generalised, yeah. It was a kind of a... It was kind of a very intimidating, very society that was expressed so much hatred
towards the British Army.
Yeah, as an 18-year-old who was probably only had a couple of fights in the playground, it wasn't easy to kind of accept the hatred that was expressed by certain members of the community.
And well, you saw that as when you were on patrol in the streets.
Yeah.
How was it expressed? What happened?
Verbal anger.
Yeah.
Missiles being thrown at you.
What sort of missiles?
Stones, rocks, batteries, nuts, bolts, anything that could be
anything
picked up.
Anything laid hands on.
Anything could be picked up was thrown.
Yeah.
But I think the problem with that was you were very close to the people who were trying to, well, they were trying to kill you.
Yeah.
Well, they wanted to. So kind of, you could see the eyes, you could see the faces, you connected with them. It's a difficult way to say, really, but you built up a kind of a relationship with a person that was trying to kill you or wanted to kill you.
Yeah.
And that left a totally different perspective than being shot at or being bombed. They were just events.
But that happened as well, though. But they were, I suppose they're more... It wasn't personal, was it, when someone's trying to shoot at you or blow you up?
Yeah, but you don't see the person that's planted the bomb. You don't see the person, if they're a sniper... You occasionally saw a gunman, but you didn't see the sniper that was trying to shoot you. It was just part of the day's work.
And you experienced that as well?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Right, you were talking last night that a bullet nearly hit you?
Yeah, and a couple.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're always going to get shot at as a patrol, as a group, but, you know, it's not always that you're the individual target.
Yeah.
You were in the sniper's...
Were you sort of on your own, but you knew that... Or in a group at that time?
No, all in groups, yeah.
You knew that the sniper was trying to...
Yeah, you pick that up. You know where it lands.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it happened a couple of times. And how long were you out there for? Two tours, was it?
Two tours in 72, yeah.
Yeah. And how did that make you feel? When were you aware of how it made you feel? Because you're a boy, aren't you, when you were doing that?
Yeah, I was only 18, and it doesn't... You're not aware of it. I think it was the early days of the conflict.
Yeah.
And I don't think everything was right. The pre-deployment preparation was quite poor, really, in one sense.
You wouldn't have understood the politics at that age, would you, as a young boy?
No, weren't even expressed to us.
No.
You got on the plane and get off the plane at the other end and you're doing your job.
And then you've come out of the army, you've gone into civvy life, and you didn't feel right, did you? You've been telling us over the last couple of days.
No, I didn't feel right at all. I had very kind of violent thoughts.
Yeah.
Very violent thoughts. And how I first noticed it straight away without being told, was hypervigilant, staring at people, staring at cars coming towards you.
Yeah, because in your head they were trying to kill you.
Well, yes, because I think when you're on the streets, when you're at your service, you subconscious very much kind of kicks in and supports you to protect yourself.
Yeah.
And then I think with some of us, when we leave, the subconscious doesn't realise we've left.
No.
And still continues working. So your subconscious is protecting you in your everyday life. And when it's in a conflict such as Northern Ireland, which is in part of the UK, it's not in a foreign land, it's not with a foreign-speaking enemy.
No.
Then it becomes more... it becomes part of everyday life.
Yeah.
Because probably every street in the UK can
be... It's the same as Belfast,
can
isn't it?
Or Londonderry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And how did that affect your life then, you know, as you went through life working and family and that sort of thing?
Well, I never spoke to anything about my family. It was just something you shut off.
You didn't tell them?
No, nothing.
Right.
They knew I was Ireland, but they knew nothing about what was going on. It was just something that you...
And PTSD hadn't been diagnosed at this stage?
Well, it didn't exist. PTSD didn't really exist.
It's such a long time ago.
No, 2018 was the first time that PTSD became part of an NHS treatment programme with the introduction of the NHS Veterans Complex Mental Health Service.
Yeah, yeah.
Up until that point, there was very little access.
Is this Johnny Mercer? His
Johnny Mercer yeah. introduced it, yeah. He was yeah. the first. He was the first Veterans MP.
Yes.
He kind of introduced that. But I think he was obstructed. He found struggles in trying to do what he wanted to do.
Trying to deal with the politics, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of politics that came into it.
Yeah. And then 4 or 5 years ago, you came across the Army charity, the ABF, who were doing this with.
Yeah, I'd gone through a period of kind of contemplating suicide.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I filled a glass full of Tramadol.
Okay.
And was going to kind of walk across and drink it.
Yeah.
And I'd rescued a dog about 6 years earlier, and he'd been really badly used.
Yeah.
And I can see in the dog's actions, he's got PTSD because of his cruelty.
Yeah.
And I looked
and that's
at
how
him,
you felt.
Yeah, and I looked at him and I thought to myself, if I go, who's going to look after you?
Yeah. And it was the dog that saved you, stopped you
yeah,
doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And then how did you come across the Soldiers' Charity?
Well...
The ABF.
I came across that, I was passed on to them by the Royal Engineers Association.
Yeah.
And Helena McMahon got in touch with me.
Yeah.
And they gave me a bursary.
Yeah. And what was that bursary for? That you found this hidden talent, haven't you? talent you didn't know you had.
I didn't. It wasn't hidden. I didn't know I had it.
No. Well, that's pretty hidden to me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It fairly was hidden. And I just kind of kept having these. People, you know, people say, like, you discovered art. I didn't discover art. Art discovered me.
Okay.
Art came to me. I had this obsession to be creative.
Yes.
But where are you going to be creative? Probably not in the village hall. So I for some reason, I got it in my head that I'm going to go to university.
And this is what you explained to Helen when you first met Helen from the Soldiers' Charity. And then
the
charity have helped you out with the costings of the going to university to study art.
Yeah, they helped me with their travel costs. Buying books, living costs.
Yeah.
And that kind of made it possible. Without that, it wouldn't have been possible because I didn't qualify for a full maintenance grant.
No.
So I would have struggled.
Yeah.
So they're, when they stepped in, they kind of made it quite possible for me to do it. And I struggled for the first... I didn't struggle for the first 2 years, but I struggled towards the end of the second years, and I just dropped out.
Right.
I laugh about that often because at my age, in doing having a gap year, I thought...
Yeah.
I kind of used to take to myself...
You were going to go touring around the world, were you? On backpacking or something?
No, but I went touring and I did a couple of exhibitions.
Yeah, yeah.
For the...
Art exhibitions.
Art exhibitions, yeah. Yeah. And then kind of... I was doing the second one, which lasted 18 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought to myself, I'm going to have to go back.
Yeah.
So I applied for another university and I got in there, which was quite... good, because they don't normally accept you on your third year.
Yeah.
Because...
So you'd done 2 years and this was the third year?
This was the third year, with a gap year in between it.
Yeah.
And in 2021, I qualified with a 2-1.
A 2-1, that's pretty good, isn't it, mate, after all that?
Well, it was, because half the time you wanted to pack it in.
Yeah.
You know, but something was inside you saying, I'm not going to pack this out, I've got to achieve this, I've got
it's
to do it.
It's a hidden strength, isn't it, again?
Yeah, it is. You just kind of... Well... One of the biggest issues with PTSD is rumination.
Yes.
And it's that what drives you towards suicide.
Yes.
Because you ruminate and ruminate and ruminate.
It's going round in your head.
Yeah, and then yeah. But that leads you down a pathway to depression.
Yeah.
And the depression leads you to a pathway of suicidal thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that's what's helping then, doing this art. But you didn't leave it at 2-1, did you?
No.
You then taking it onto another level with your art. What's happened then?
I took on a master's degree at the same university.
Yeah.
I finished that in July this year.
Well, yeah.
And I got a merit in that.
Oh, wow. So you've come on a long way, mate.
Yeah, I can do a PhD, but I can't afford it. It's going to be about £15,000.
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
I can't borrow any more money.
No.
So.
But it was the Soldiers' Charity that got you going, without what I refer to as a hand up, not a hand out, isn't it?
It was a hand up. They certainly lifted me up, because isolation is one of the biggest problems.
Yeah.
And isolation brings on your rheumatism.
Because you've got too much time to think, haven't you?
Yeah, so you needed an alternative. So in actual fact, the art became the rumination, but it was a positive rumination.
A positive rather than negative.
Rather than negative. And kind of like you didn't have time to think about the negative things in life, because you would probably wake up in the morning and start thinking about art. And I would probably be still thinking about art at 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah, yeah, so it's more positive.
But it was...
But there's tangible results, isn't there? Because you've got some art on display, I understand.
Yeah, I've got...
Tell us about that.
I've got 14 pieces of work in an exhibition in Bishop Wilton, near York.
Yeah.
And I've got a piece of work that's on permanent display on campus in York St John.
Wow.
I made a piece from the first, third year, and they liked it that much, they've kept it.
And that's all because you reached out for help.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And then we first met today, what's today, Friday? We first met on Tuesday evening in the Union Jack Club in London.
That's right, yeah.
First time we've met, and you said that you were anxious about meeting all these people. And here you are now. You stood up last night and did a talk to all these people. And what does this frontline walk mean to you?
Well, it's great because I'm communicating, I've met the people.
You didn't know anybody, did you, apart from Helen?
I only knew Helen. And it was really frightening because people, strangers, are I don't like using the word trigger because it's not a trigger, but they're kind of they're a negative feeling.
Mm.
They create a negative action.
Yeah.
So I was,
in your head.
Yeah.
It's
a lot of it is not so much what's actually happening, but what you perceive can happen.
Yeah, that anxiety effect.
Yeah,
isn't
and
it?
I didn't really know what to perceive from this group of people.
Yep. Yeah.
But they've kind of worked and be great. I've really, really, really kind of like. Appreciate everything they've done, because if it wasn't for this group of people raising this funds, the charity wouldn't have been able to help me.
No, and others.
So kind of like, so the charities are probably going to get the front of it all, but without the support of the frontline walkers, there wouldn't be the money for the charity. The charity couldn't function as it does.
And that's what, speaking as someone who's done this walk several times, that's what, and Paul Critchley's in front of me. Paul's on his back, he's six, are you Paul at the moment? He's not listening to me, are you? Paul? What number walk are you on?
Six.
And it drives people like me and Paul and others here to come back time and time again to help people like you. And you'd encourage other people to come and join us on the frontline walk next year, would you?
Yeah, I would encourage people to come along.
Yeah.
And if people come along next year, if I'm invited, I'll come back and walk with you again.
Yeah, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? What a change. What a change in your attitude between Tuesday night and Friday, isn't it? I've seen you sort of grow and... get used to people and really embrace the event, haven't you?
Because that fear
has gone.
Nobody's really scared me here. And
that's a relief, isn't it?
It is.
No one scared you, not even Paul.
Not even Paul, nobody scared me. Only Brenda.
That's great news, that really is.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm looking forward to kind of the future, what's going to do.
That's great news. We're halfway through. We're going to go down from here and then finish at Vimy Ridge this afternoon, and tomorrow we're at Passion Down. We're going to finish up at the Menin Gate, and we know that'll be a very special event for you and everybody else.
Yeah, I think it is, really, because with suffering complex PTSD, you can actually, and I studied trench art for my dissertation in my degree, and I can obviously, the life in the First World War trenches was part of that. So I can visualise what these soldiers probably went through from that perspective.
And you got your own personal experience to match that to as well.
Well, I can understand the trauma.
Yeah.
I can understand that the...
Which we can't as civilians, and that's what brings me here, because I can't understand any of that.
Well, I can. I can relate to everything that went on.
Yeah.
I can relate to the 306 that were shot at dawn.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those were probably... We're just shell shock.
Yeah,
victims.
We know that. Yeah.
And kind of like, yeah. I can understand.
Because you were there, weren't you, in that situation?
I was in that situation at a different era.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't in a trench as such.
No.
But you
had the same feelings.
Oh yeah, I can.
Same
relate.
Emotions.
I can relate.
Anxieties.
It happens today. How many soldiers are committing suicide today?
Mm-hmm.
They're getting to that desperate point of no return. That most of them are hanging themselves.
Well, I think to finish with, I think this is an appeal from me personally, that if there's any veterans, no matter how long you served in the British Army, this is what the charity's here for, the Army, what was the Army Benevolent Fund, ABF, a soldiers charity. Please reach out and come to us, because they're, and you're living proof that there is help, not just financial help, but emotional and practical support here for you, and we won't stop until these deaths stop, will we?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that the charity has given me is not the bursary. Was I couldn't have done the unit without the bursary.
Yeah.
But it's creating a situation where you are engaging with people.
Yes. Yeah.
Like on this walk.
Yeah.
It helps me reassess my kind of my recovery.
Yes.
I can meet people that I've never met before.
And you'll go back into your home life and be able to go out and meet people.
Well, I'm not saying I'll be able to go out and do that. It doesn't work that way, as simple as that. But it's a stepping stone.
It'll give you the tools.
Yeah, it gives me that understanding that it's possible.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thanks for that, John.
No problem.
Enjoy the rest of the walk.
I will do. Thank you very much.
I cannot begin to tell you how difficult it was for John to tell his story. It was the second time he told it, because he told us the story the night before. And there were many tears, not just from him, but from everybody else as well. And it made us focus on why we were there, why we were doing this. So we moved on. We moved on with the second half of the frontline walk. So on the third and final day, we began at Vancouver Corner, the brooding soldier memorial to the Canadians that held the line there when the gas attack came from the Germans in April of 1915. And then we moved down to Poker Pell, where we told the story of the musician that we started this podcast with. And then it was on to Tynecot, the final resting place of nearly 12,000 soldiers. We've covered Tynecot a few times in this podcast. But there was one grave that I wanted to show people, and it was the grave of a man called Samuel Rudge. He was killed in action on the 3rd of October 1917, not far from Tynecot, while serving with the Royal Berkshire Regiment, 1st 4th Battalion. And it was an incredible coincidence. We've talked about this before, haven't we? And that coincidence in this case goes back to 2017, the frontline walk of that year. And again, the third day, we were walking across the Passchendaele Ridge. We were approaching Tynecot. And there was a man called Darren Parker who'd served in the British Army, in the Royal Military Police. And on that frontline walk that year, Darren and two of his former comrades decided to do the walk itself. And on that third morning, he received an email from his aunt in New Zealand, and she asked him to keep a lookout for his ancestor, this Samuel Rudge, who was apparently buried, in her words, somewhere on the Western Front. And I said to Darren, well, it's going to be impossible, really. He could be buried anywhere. He didn't know he was in Tynecot. But then we discovered that that's where he was. And 2 hours later, that's where we were, standing by the grave of Samuel Rudge. And it was an incredible coincidence. It felt as though Samuel was pulling us towards him. So many people had those same feelings. And there was Darren kneeling at the grave of the ancestor that had died at Passchendaele. Subsequent research discovered that Samuel was killed by shellfire less than a mile from where he's now buried. It was one of those quiet days on the battlefield. Just 5 men in his battalion was killed that day. His body was initially buried by his comrades where he fell, but it was exhumed and reburied in Tynecot in September 1919, 2 years after he died. And next to him, a man was exhumed from the same grave, must have died with him, but he has no identity. And there he lay, almost forgotten until that day, on a cold October morning, 6 years ago now. And in his own words, Darren said to me, when I woke up that morning, I had no idea that Samuel Rudge even existed. Now there I was, close to where he died 100 years ago, feeling such strong emotions for a man I didn't even know. And then we made our way up the hill to Crest Farm, a place where there's a Canadian memorial, because it was the Canadians that finally took this ridge in the November of 1917. And here we remembered a man called Graham Adam, who was one of 300 Canadian casualties on the 6th of November 1916, as they had successfully attacked what was left of the village of Passchendaele. Like so many others, his body was lost, and he's remembered in his case on the Meningate Memorial. And after he was killed, his father wrote this very emotional letter about his son. He said, "We used to hear regularly from Graham somewhere in France. He used to write very amusingly and pluckily. He was wounded in the face and was sent to the base hospital, where he was marked as PB, which meant permanent base. We were very relieved at this, as it meant he would never return to the front line. Alas, about the time the Passchendaele offensive took place and every available man was sent up. On the 6th of November, we got a telegram to say that Private Graham Adam of the 36th Battalion, he'd been drafted from the 56th, was missing. We made every possible inquiry through Hubert Mann and others, but never heard any trace of him, so presume he must have been blown up by a shell in that terrible campaign. Dear boy, he was anything but warlike, and he must have hated trench life and all the horrors of wars, but was very, very plucky, and must have done as well, as he was a company runner when he met his end, and his name is on the Meningate." Those two stories about Samuel Rudge and Graham Adam are taken from a book that myself and historian Steve Roberts produced a few years ago called The Frontline Walk. And there are dozens of similar stories in the book, and it's still available. You can get it from either Amazon or from the Soldiers Charity shop, or from myself. Needless to say, if you get it from me or from the charity, all of the proceeds go towards the Soldiers Charity itself. All of the costs of producing the book were covered by a crowdfunding campaign. So the final afternoon of the walk then took everyone through Zonnebeek, which was our lunch stop, and then through the beautiful Polygon Wood and the Butt Cemetery there. And as they walkers came out of Polygon Wood, they suddenly came across the memorial to the Royal Highlanders, the 1st Battalion of the Black Watch. It's a bronze statue that was designed in Edinburgh by sculptor Alan Herriot, and it depicts a Black Watch sergeant going into action in the autumn of 1914, that first Battle of Ypres. Lynn MacDonald, in her book, 1914, The Last Days of Hope, said it was here that the battle was won. It was here that the Battle of War itself was nearly lost. On the 13th of August 1941, 31 officers and 1,031 soldiers of the 1st Battalion embarked for France. They took part in a number of battles in those first few months, and fighting withdrawals, they faced this relentless German army that was pressing forward. And by the 11th of November, despite receiving some reinforcements, they were down to just 9 officers and 228 other ranks. And it's said that there was less than 8,000 British soldiers facing the Kaiser's elite, the Prussian Guard, who had more than twice that number. And the main assault from the Germans came just north of the Menin Road and fell upon the Black Watch, the Scots Guards, and the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders. And on the 11th of November, the Black Watch history says that between 6:30 a.m. and the 9th, the heaviest bombardment so far experienced by the British forces broke out. And as it lifted, a division of the Prussian Guard, ordered by the Kaiser to break the British line at all costs, attacked the front. Under cover of the bombardment, a strong enemy force drove back D Company and 2 platoons of A Company entrenched at the southwest corner of Polygon Wood. C Company, under the command of Lieutenant Anderson, and in a strong point 380 yards of the south and west corner of Polygon Wood, held out firmly. This split the attack into small parties of 20 to 30 Prussians, many of whom were soon lost in the woods behind. As they emerged from the back of the woods, the guns of the 41st Brigade of the Royal Field Artillery opened direct fire on the enemy at a range of 300 to 400 yards. The effect was devastating and the German attack faltered. And at 3 p.m. a counter-attack by the 2nd Battalion of the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry destroyed the remnants of the Prussian Guard, and the line between the Menin Road and Polygon Wood was established. On the following day, the day after the battle, the strength of this 1st Battalion was now reduced to just 2 officers and 109 other ranks. But they held the line. They held the line at what now is called Blackwatch Corner, and where that beautiful bronze statue of that Sergeant Blackwatch can now be seen, and the weary frontline walkers past that as they made their way towards the Menin Road, and that awful place, the most dangerous place on earth for probably the whole 4 years of the war, arguably Hoog. So from Hoog, which again is covered in a previous podcast, the walkers made their way downhill. They went through the Lille Gate, they had a beer, and then formed up and moved through the Groat Market. Now a thriving city, a thriving place on a Saturday afternoon. The shoppers, the drinkers and the people that were eating, they came out of the restaurants and they applauded the walkers as they made their way towards the Menin Gate, now of course shrouded in canvas and scaffolding. And on the other side of the Menin Gate, as they made their way out of the tunnel, they received their medal, they realised they'd completed the task, and they started to show their raw emotions, the sheer physical effort of the last few days that some of these people had done several times before, and it all came out. They started to weep, they started to hug each other, they started to thank each other for helping them along the way over these last 3 gruelling days. And then the heavens opened. Ironic, really, because that's what turned these battlefields in October of 1917, November of 1917, into the awful quagmire. The heavens opened and soaked everyone, but nobody cared. No one cared. They were just relieved that they'd done their bit to raise so much money for the veterans of today. They had their photo taken, and then they reconvened later on, having had a rest, showered, and maybe another drink or two. And 3 of the frontline walkers, including David Taylor, who didn't take part this year, but in the previous year in the Normandy frontline walk had had a very serious heart attack. He laid the wreath along with 2 other of the walkers, Chris Byrne and Paul Critchley, who had raised so much money, the 3 top fundraisers. They laid a wreath at the Menin Gate as part of the last post ceremony. And to finish with, let's just listen to the words of some of those walkers as they talked about their experiences in the last few days.
So we're at the Menin Gate and we're just waiting for the last post ceremony. I'm here with two young ladies, 2 daughters, one daughter, sorry, and a mum. And they've just spent the last 3 days walking the battlefields of the Somme, Vimy and Ypres. And introduce yourselves, first of all.
Hello there, I'm Lee. I'm Charlotte's mum.
I'm Charlotte, the daughter.
And I've said all along, you two are like a couple of sisters doing this today. So what made you want to do this in the first place, this frontline walk? Whose idea was it?
It was my idea initially. I've got 4 family members that I know. My granddad was actually served in Ypres in 1917. And Charlotte grabbed the opportunity to come with me. She looked at it more for the challenging of the physical. But you've learned so much, haven't you?
You know, it was the physical challenge that sort of drew me to it. And I came in without any knowledge whatsoever. And I'm very open about that. Yeah. I'm only 19, so there's not so much. I don't learn much about this. And I've come here and it's been the best history lesson I could have ever asked for. And all the gravestones I see my age everywhere, and it's not mum's age, and it's not, it's me, it's my brother, who's only 18, that would have been. So it's crazy to see that, and it becomes really real. I thought it wouldn't be applicable to me, but it is me.
You were very emotional earlier on, weren't you?
I was. I held hands with my mum as we walked through Menin Gate.
Yeah.
And I was streaming. I couldn't believe it. I was so proud and seeing everyone else. It's like everyone's hugging and cheering and people were clapping us down the way. It's just
it's been amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and you said that 4 relatives, was it great-granddad, you said, came home?
No, it's my granddad.
And he's walked through here, he's walked through the Menin Gate all those years ago.
He didn't come home totally unscarred emotionally, but he made it.
Did you know him?
Yes, yeah. I knew my granddad. I was only a small child when he passed, but yes, I knew granddad.
Did he tell you anything about it?
Not me, but he told his sons.
Did he?
Yeah, he told his sons, but he didn't want to tell the information. He was
had to be dragged out of it.
Yes, yeah.
There was one thing he said.
One thing that he did say to my uncle was that he, after the Second World War, he just said, son, my uncle was too young to fight in the Second World War, but he just said, son, if there's ever any more war, please don't go.
Don't go, no. Did he volunteer?
He did, yes. He volunteered. He came here when he was still 17.
Wow, so he shouldn't have been here at all.
Just turning 18.
Yeah.
He was born in 1899. And
still too young.
Yes. Yeah. And he was here. He served in the army until 1920.
Right.
In the end.
A bit longer, yeah.
Yes.
A bit longer than the end of the war.
Yes, okay. Yeah. He was out in Germany, I believe.
Right, yeah.
After the war. Mm. And he was doing
a... occupation force.
Yes, yeah. Okay. So...
wonder what that was like.
Do you know, none of us in the family know, and it's something I would love to know.
Yeah. Well, we'll love to see. We've got some soldiers to research, haven't we, when we get back?
Yes, definitely.
We're going to go through those.
I've got a family member on the Menin Gate
as
well.
You can't see them because it's...
No, unfortunately not. But he was 1915.
Yeah.
So,
we'll look at those another time.
A great uncle.
Is this your first visit? It's your first visit.
Oh, it won't be the last, that is
for sure.
You're
going to come back, aren't you?
Definitely. I've never even been to Belgium before, and now this is how I was welcomed in, so it was quite special.
Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about this the other day, that we don't often get people of your age come on the Frontline Walk.
No.
But it's so important, because we're a load of old duffers come on this, and we're looking, you know, we're looking for your generation, people of your age to take this back
and
keep these memories alive of these
men. When I go home, I plan on talking as much as I can about it. And you don't need to feel worried when you don't know enough, because actually that's the best thing. And like I said, it's the best history lesson. There's no silly question.
And we're still finding out stuff, you realise.
Exactly.
That? No,
everyone's learning.
No expert.
Everyone's learning. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I hope to see you back out here very soon.
You will.
So enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
So we're standing near the Menin Gate on the bridge, goes around the moat, and we're just waiting for the last post ceremony to begin. And I've got two guys with me that are regular faces on the Frontline Walk, but very special reason to be walking. First of all, introduce yourselves.
Hi Terry, I'm Simon Ruggett.
Yeah. Hi Terry, I'm Paul Hodgson.
And so how many times have you now done this walk between you?
This is my fourth Western Front.
You've done the same?
I've done four, yeah. You've done five now, so it's nine between us.
Okay.
Nine between us.
And what made you want to do it in the first place then, Paul?
For me, just my background, my granddad's, and just following their story, my great-granddad's. My great-granddad, sadly died from gas from the First World War.
After the war?
After the war, yeah. He returned in 1915 and died in 2022. Or, sorry.
1922.
Yeah,
so it's taken that long.
It's taken that long. It took 7 years.
Wow.
Of what his doctor called the slow death.
And that inspired you, his story, to come and do this in the first place?
Yeah, it inspired me, to come and, follow in his footsteps.
And you literally have followed his footsteps.
Yes.
And Simon, tonight you're going to lay a wreath as part of the ceremony.
This is to my great-uncle Cyril.
Yeah.
So Paul started the walk the year before me. I've always liked my history. But then found out about my great-uncle Cyril, who died. He was killed just outside of Ypres, December 1915, by a gas attack.
Yeah.
They never found him. His name's on the Menin Gate.
He's here,
so
yeah.
When we finished the walk, the previous two times I've done this walk, the other walk I did was Normandy, I can see his name.
Yeah.
And I thought this year I'd bring a wreath. Yeah. And it's an ABF wreath with Cyril's name on.
Yeah. And did he have children then?
No, he was, I think he was 19, something
like that.
Right,
so he hadn't had an opportunity to start a family.
No, he was young, So, but I came here with my dad about 10 years ago, and we went out and kind of found
the spot
pretty much.
Do you remember where it was, whereabouts?
It's just north, kind of just northeast of Ypres, and I think there's a Lancashire farm or something like that.
Oh, right, yeah, just by the canal.
Yeah, which was like the regimental HQ, I think.
Yeah.
And then the front line moved back and forth so much. All the cemeteries around there are like...
Yeah, so many of those
so
were lost
close.
At that
yeah,
time.
So...
Because that was the jumping off point then for the 1917
Battle of Passchendaele. Yeah, so I presume he's out there somewhere and they got overrun and, you know, that was that.
What does it mean to you to be able to do this then tonight?
An awful lot.
Yeah.
An awful lot. And my legs are aching and I'm tired. So,
it's one
of those...
walked a long way, yeah.
It's... You just think about them all the way, and Paul and I talk a lot on these walks, and I think it is it's a very emotional trip. every time, even though we've done it multiple times.
Yeah.
But to just put that effort in and feel a little bit of effort and pain, so you know, minimum.
What they went
through. Yeah, minimal, but just to put the effort in feels like a good thing to do.
Brilliant. And Paul, what would you say to anyone who's listening to this podcast, who's thinking about doing, I know we've had lots of people have contacted me and said, oh, I think about doing that next year, and they haven't actually done it yet. What would you say to them?
I think it's a great experience. I think it's something everyone should do. I think it's important, yeah. You meet great people, you make great friends, and it really is a family.
And how would you suggest they went around the fundraising? They've got to raise £1,250, is it, as a minimum?
Yeah, I think if you sort of reach out to your local network, your friends, your family, and also if you're working to do things at work, it is possible. It seems a lot, but
break it down into chunks, isn't it, over a year, it's only
break it down to different events. I mean, some people do coffee mornings, you know, some people
quiz
do
nights and
quiz
things.
Nights, raffles.
Yeah. Companies give you a contribution as well, right? They'll multiply it.
And colleagues will support you as well.
Yeah, so it's possible.
Certainly the first one you ever do, you're going to get the support.
Yeah. There's no such thing as can't, is there?
No, definitely no.
Don't feel any shame doing it, just tap people up.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks so much for that, guys.
Okay, you're welcome.
Good luck with that.
Thanks, Terry.
So I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Tales from the Battlefields. Thank you once again for tuning in and all the people that have been reviewing and rating the podcast. It really does make a difference. You can do that on Amazon Music and Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you're interested, if this has inspired you to do the Frontline Walk for next year, we do two walks, one across the Normandy D-Day battlefields and this one across the Western Front battlefields, following the route that I've described in this podcast, then you can get more information if you go to the Soldiers Charity, ABF, the Soldiers Charity page, or if you contact me, I'll give you the contacts and more information about it. And as usual this week, well, remember all of the soldiers that we talked about in this podcast by playing The Last Post.